Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 455. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope OPC up in Grays Lake, Illinois. We're back for another wonderful episode with you today. Let me introduce to you our panel. We have Glenn Clary, who is the pastor of Providence Presbyterian Church in Pflugerville, Texas. Welcome back, Glenn. It's good to have you with us today.
Thanks, Camden. It's great to be back representing Texas today.
Yeah, representing Texas. You're filling in for some of our other brothers who are unable to be with us. But we've got a lot of Reform Forum folks down in Texas. Hopefully we'll see you soon here in October when a bunch will be up here for our conference coming up October 7th through 9th. But before I say anything more about that, I want to introduce our guest today. We're welcoming back to the program Dr. Richard Gaffin, who is a professor emeritus from Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Of course, many of our listeners will know him from the many books that he's written and the many years of service he's committed to the Reformed tradition and specifically to the Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Westminster as he's taught New Testament and biblical and systematic theology there. Welcome back, Dr. Gaffin. It's good to speak with you today.
Hey, thanks, Camden. It's good to be with you again. I can't claim to represent anyone or any area.
We know. Yeah, since even now you've moved after spending so much time in the Philadelphia area, calling from a different location from Virginia, but we want to thank you for your time today and looking forward to speaking with you today about Calvin and his views on the Sabbath. We're opening up a book Dr. Gaffin has written, originally a THM thesis, but has been published now by Mentor Christian Focus, Calvin and the Sabbath, The Controversy of Applying the Fourth Commandment. We're going to get into that in just a moment, but before we do so, I've got a couple things to mention to our listeners. As I mentioned earlier, we do have our conference coming up October 7th and 8th. And then if you're able to stay over for the Lord's Day on the 9th, 2016, we're welcoming everyone back to Hope OPC in Grays Lake for a conversation and a conference on the image of God. So we're welcoming Glenn Clary, who's going to be speaking about the second commandment and the image of God and how those relate. Jim Cassidy will be up here as well. Jeff Waddington, Lane Tipton will be back, and I'll be speaking, and we're planning to have another great event with a lot of folks from around the country and even around the world coming to speak about the Sabbath. Dr. Gaffin, you were here with us last year. Did you enjoy your time? I guess it's dangerous for me to ask you on here, but I imagine that you enjoyed your time. You were here with Lane last year, and things seemed to go well for our conference.
Oh, very much. I felt, even though I'd never had the opportunity of being at the conference before, I felt very much at home and really valued that opportunity of being with the group. And sounds like a great conference shaping up for this year, and really hope there will be a good turnout and a good result.
Yeah, thanks. We do too. We got quite a few folks that are registered. We're having another dinner event as well. So a lot of opportunity here to connect, and there's still time to register. Information is all online at reformedforum.org/conference, and you can register and attend and join with us. We hope to have another good group of folks and a good conversation all surrounded around the image of God theme this year. An important topic, never ceases to be significant, but there's a whole host of new things that we need to address and a lot of stuff going on. So join with us today. And if you're not able to be here in person, you, of course, can find the recordings. And we hope to stream things on YouTube as well again this year. So reformedforum.org/conference for information on that. Well, brothers, it's good to get together today and to speak about the Lord's Day and speak about the Sabbath and some historical theology, speaking about the Reformation and John Calvin. As we open up this book, I have a 2008 reprint in front of me. Our listeners may have the same copy if they have one. They may also have one printed in 1998. But Dr. Gaffin, as we get started, I wanted to ask you about the origins of this project to begin with. You write in the very beginning that this started off as a THM thesis done under the oversight of Professor John Murray back in 1961 to 1962. Can you speak to us a bit about this project and what was your original interest in writing on Calvin and the Sabbath back in the 60s?
Yeah, I can't recall exactly what originally sparked my interest or being drawn to this topic, but I did become aware of certain claims that were made about Calvin's view of the Lord's Day. Claims were that, particularly drawing a contrast with the so-called Puritan Sabbath that developed later and then has its confessional expression in the Westminster Standard, both catechisms as well as the confession. So I guess I would say it was as much as anything to try to satisfy for myself what the historical state of affairs was, what Calvin's view was, try to determine that as carefully as I could, and then to see just how it did compare, say, with the Westminster Standard's view of the Sabbath. John Murray encouraged me in that. I just comment further that as things have fallen out, there was a larger value for me personally in terms of my personal calling career in working on the project as I did early on in my theological study. As you pointed out, it originated as a THM thesis at Westminster. It drew me into studying Calvin and the demands there are on any topic in Calvin because of his corpus of writings, commentaries, the Institutes, and other writings. It just served very well in enabled me to develop somewhat and being able to study Calvin and enter into Calvin studies in a responsible way. Not that I consider myself any, first-line Calvin scholars, anything like that, but it did research, it did sharpen research tools.
Yeah, and certainly, speaking of research tools and the process of scholarship back then, I had a brief question that might help our listeners understand something. I wanted to ask you, you raised an issue in the preface, I believe, of the book, and I wanted to ask for some clarity. What exactly is a non-electric Smith Corona?
I'm not sure. Look, get some video out of the 50s or 60s, and that's what people had to use, typewriter without, first there were typewriters, then there were electric typewriters,
right.
And then the word processing era comes on, and it, for my poor wife, this, who had to do the typing, the thesis originated on a typewriter, a non-electric typewriter. Later on, when she had to type my doctoral dissertation about 7-8 years later, we were lent an electric typewriter, and that facilitated things somewhat. But for a younger generation, you really don't know how blessed we are with word processing and its advent and its capacities.
Yeah, back then you used to actually have to think about what you wanted to say before you wrote it down.
Well, all right, maybe that's a downside.
No, it's an advantage because you used to have to think logically. Now people just, throw things onto a screen and say, I'll move them around later.
That's maybe a downside of
the word processor.
Word process, the advent of the word processing era.
Yeah. Fair enough. What was going on in scholarship back then? I know it's a little while ago, but was not only Calvin, but were Sabbath discussions and the theology of the Sabbath, was that in the air? Was that a polemical issue back in the 60s?
Well, I think particularly within a Reformed tradition, the issue of Sabbath observance has always been a lesser or a greater issue. It's always been receiving some attention. At that time, and I later became involved in an organization, the Reformed Ecumenical Synod, on a study committee, as a minister in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. The OPC was a member of that organization, which eventually has, so far as OPC membership is concerned, has saw the OPC having to lead the organization over certain doctrinal developments and become part of the International Council of Reformed Churches. But in the early 70s, I became involved in a study committee, which I mention because it's in the background of or related to this whole issue of Calvin and the Sabbath. And that's the churches in the Reformed Ecumenical Synod. They had their confessional bases either in the Westminster Standards, the British American Presbyterian denominations, or in the case of the continental, primarily Dutch and South African denominations. Their standards are the three forms of unity. The three forms of unity do not address the Sabbath issue in the way in which the Westminster Standards do, and that's eventually resulted in a distinction being made between the continental view of the Sabbath, a Reformed continental view, and the Westminster Standards view. And then Calvin is often appealed to as a representative of the continental view, which finds expression, for instance, in, I think it's question 103 of the Heidelberg Catechism. I think also was in the background there that at that time, what is the Westminster view of the Sabbath had really become the view that, even if it wasn't in the three forms of unity, had really taken hold in large stretches of the continental Reformed churches. For instance, Abram Kuyper has views on the Sabbath, highly influential, say, within the CRC in North America, Christian Reformed Church in North America, that are very, Kuyper's views are very close to those of the Westminster Standards. And so I would say, in effect, as you're coming into the middle of the 20th century, if I just put it in terms of denominations, the OPC and the CRC had largely similar views of the Lord's Day and observance of the Lord's Day, but that begins to break down, I would say, in the period beginning 1960 and following, and then did lead, I think, to this study committee in the RES that I mentioned, Reformed Ecumenical Synod, that I became a part of, and really, in my own mind, is a piece with what I contributed to that committee is of, was building on a lot of conclusions I came to in dealing with Calvin. That's a rather long answer, but you ask a wide-ranging question.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks.
I'm wondering, Dr. Gaffin, is that really the origin of the distinction between the Puritan view of the Sabbath versus the continental view of the Sabbath, or did that debate precede the 60s and 70s and this discussion that was going on between the OPC, CRC, and others?
Oh, I think it definitely preceded. That's a good question, Glenn. I'm not sure where that kind of distinction emerged and became more or less commonplace. I was trying to say a lot in answer to the previous question. I think as someone growing up in the OPC and having a lot of contacts with CRC, there was pretty much agreement that the kind of observance of the Sabbath that is finds expression in the Westminster Standards. That also was present in the CRC, and that was beginning to not to be the case. There was more and more an abandonment of how the Sabbath ought to be kept as presented in the Westminster Standards. I don't know if that helps.
Mm-hmm. In the CRC.
Yes.
Right. Well, I'm wondering, Dr. Gaffin, if you can take us into your treatise, and you begin the book, chapter one, by summarizing various theories regarding the Sabbath or the Lord's Day, and you introduce some categories that I think are very helpful. Perhaps you can explain that to us.
I wonder if I could move us to, so far as the book is concerned, to the final chapter where I give a summary of matters that I have developed throughout the book. What I try to do at the very beginning of the book is survey various theory, various views of the Sabbath in a very, I'm sure someone would consider it not, superficial in a lot of ways, views of the Sabbath leading up to the, or in place on the eve of the Reformation, particularly in the Roman Catholic Church, and with the way in which the law was functioning within the whole within Roman Catholic theology and church life had taken on. Observing the fourth commandment had taken on a very legalistic strain. And that, I think, is what is the setting against which Calvin reacts and then develops his views as he does.
Yes, and that's a historical background to the writings of Calvin and the other reformers regarding the Sabbath is very helpful. And you mentioned, I remember correctly, in the first chapter that there were basically four views among the reformers, one being an antinomian view taken by some Anabaptists, another the Seventh-day Sabbatarian view, also taken by some Anabaptists, and then the dominical view and the Sabbatarian view. Can you elaborate on those for us?
There were different views on how binding the Sabbath was, particularly in the Sabbatarian view, but that the Sabbatarian view, which marked Roman Catholicism, was the prevailing one that Calvin was reacting against. Now, obviously, the reformers always saw themselves involved in a two front war, as we might put it, against Rome, its tradition, principle, and its soteriological legalism, and then, as you indicated, the antinomian side, the extreme side of the Reformation, the left wing of the Reformation, if you would. But, I didn't really get into, addressing that whole state of affairs in detail. I was just trying to give a sketch that would provide a background for Calvin's views.
Now, you mentioned some of the historical context there in this two-front war that the reformers are fighting. What was the context of just general feast days and Sabbath observances during the Reformation, this medieval time period? You know, I think one guy I was reading, if you were caught shaving or washing your head, you had to do penance for 20 days. And if you did it again, you might have to do penance for 40 days. And if you did it again, you were cast out as a Judas.
Yes.
For shaving.
Yeah, well, that's enlightening, but I think that's that would square with the impressions I have.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Now you have other churches who might make you do penance for not shaving and coming to worship.
Yeah, sounds very Pharisaical.
Yeah.
in many ways. Just a quick question about the current state of the question of the Sabbath, Dr. Gaffin. In my experience, it seems to me like within the Reformed Church today, and even more broadly within evangelicalism, the two dominant views are the dominical view or the Sabbatarian view. And I would say within evangelicalism, it seems to be the dominical view, which of course is the view that the Lord's Day is not the continuation of the Christian Sabbath in its new covenant form, but it's a distinct ordinance given to the Christian church. And I think, I mean, maybe as an example of a book that advocates that view is the book that D.A. Carson edited, from Sabbath to Lord's Day.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's probably the dominant view within evangelicalism, in that Sabbatarianism is something that's characterizes the Reformed theology and the Reformed Church in our day. And was that an assessment you would agree with?
Yeah, pretty well. I think the dominical view can have, I think, a differing basis. As you expressed it in describing it, it can see the first day, Lord's Day, as mandated by the New Testament. I think others tend to see it as a sort of a non-binding arrangement, appropriate arrangement that the church, New Testament church, has arrived at in order to facilitate worship, which I think is I think Calvin's view would be somewhere between those approaches. He would not see a Lord's Day as mandated in the New Testament, particularly the first day of the week. On the other hand, he would see that a time to be set apart for public worship would be a one day a week set apart, whether the first or another, would be appropriate to what the fourth commandment requires. So, yeah, the dominical view, an evangelical view like that, which is espoused in from Sabbath to Lord's Day, would not see the fourth commandment having any direct application under the so far as a weekly observance is concerned, under the new covenant, as I would understand it, as I would understand that view. As our discussion began, I made a distinction or drew a distinction between the Continental Reformed and the Westminster Standards view. That translates, I would say, not exactly parallel, but more or less correlatively to the distinction between dominical and Sabbatarian view. The Westminster Standards would surely be seen as crown witness for the Sabbatarian view. The dominical view, particularly by non-Reformed evangelicals, would have nothing about the Decalogue informing it, mm-hmm. whereas for Continental Reformed, you will see in the Heidelberg Catechism what it does say about the Sabbath is in the section where it's discussing the role of the law in the Christian life. So I don't know if that helps make a distinction.
Yeah, that's a very helpful distinction. Thank you. I wonder if you can, and I know you do this in your book, and this is a wonderful part of the book, your explanation of the significance of the Sabbath. What is the Sabbath a sign of? What is the Sabbath all about? From the beginning, it was instituted at creation. You make a good, strong argument that it's a creation ordinance. And you also argue for the moral perpetuity of the Sabbath in the New Covenant era. But I just wonder if you can, what is at the root of the Sabbath? What is it a sign of? What is the significance of the Sabbath day?
Yeah, as I before I answer, I dive into that question, let me just back up a second. Since the previous question raised the issue of the contrasting views presently, later on in my work, actually I'm able to refer to it in this Calvin and the Sabbath book, but subsequent to where the substance of the book originated, which was the master's thesis back in the 60s, in the volume commemorating the OPC's 50th anniversary, mm-hmm. My piece there, in effect, is a critique of the basic thesis of the book edited by Carson from Sabbath mm-hmm. to Lord's Day. So that would provide some further perspective, at least in my views on that of that issue. Keeping in mind that the volume in hand that we're discussing, Calvin and the Sabbath, what I developed by way of Sabbath theology is in response to Calvin. Maybe I could just say, before I answer your question, just say a couple things about Calvin's view and where I find it inadequate. I think it's important to underline that Calvin is, we talked a little bit about it earlier, however inadequately, about what the views were on predominating, particularly in Roman Catholic setting, Catholicism in the north of Europe at the time of Calvin. Calvin's in reaction to that legalism. Very much, I think you can see that in his dealing with the Fourth Commandment. But I think that at the same time, putting yourself in Calvin's shoes, if I might, or in the shoes of any reformer grasped by the gospel, as those men were at that time, and the need for reformation, Sabbath keeping, Sabbath observance is not a first order issue or priority, as they're concerned with working out particularly a sound understanding of the doctrine of justification, as they're concerned to adequately give it a proper place to tradition in maintaining the scripture alone principle. So they're occupied with the solas that we are with which we identify the Reformation. So this this doesn't keep this doesn't make the issue a Sabbath issue a first order priority. So I think that needs to be kept in mind. Where, as I looked into Calvin, on the one hand, he sees that the Sabbath has a grounding in creation. And you can see that in his commentary on Genesis. On the other hand, in the Institutes, where I think it's fair to say he's setting out his theology in discussing the law, the positive role that the law has in the life of the believer there in Institutes 2 and Section 8 on the Sabbath. He addresses the whole issue in a way that loses sight of the and fails to do justice, let's put it that way, to the Sabbath as a creation ordinance. He would not say the weekly Sabbath is a creation or he wouldn't, I think, affirm a weekly Sabbath as a creation ordinance in the way in which I think the scriptures demanded of us. But he rather sees it as involving a typology that was present in the expressed in the fourth commandment, a typology of rest that has been fulfilled and realized in Christ, so that any typology that the fourth commandment is in view in the fourth commandment is not applicable to the church today. All right. Now, with that said about Calvin, if to turn to address the question you raised, so I think that as we weigh Scripture, the Sabbath is an ordinance given, a weekly Sabbath is an ordinance given to the image-bearing creature at creation and prior to the fall. And it sets, a weekly Sabbath sets forth a rest as a type of eternal rest or an eschatological resting point toward which the image-bearing creature is called to work. I think that that comes out in Hebrews 3 and 4. And the way in which the writer argues they're basing the eschatological rest that's still in store for the people of God on what is said in Genesis 2, 2, and 3. So that the typology of the Sabbath rest is points is best understood, if I could just try to summarize it very broadly this way. Adam was called as an image-bearing creature to fulfill a task that would bring about the Sabbath rest, the fulfillment of the attainment of eschatological rest from the work that he was called to do, to which the weekly Sabbath pointed for him. And to come to the heart of the issue, Christ has secured the rest that was forfeited in Adam. But the rest that he has secured is, to put it in terms familiar to some in the New Testament setting, it's a rest realized in an already not yet pattern. So that the rest in view for Adam that has that Adam was to attain to but failed to attain to is the rest that Christ has secured inalienably for his people. But in a way in which it is both present and still future. Now, back to Calvin's view, by way of comparison, for Calvin, the fourth commandment is only about the spiritual rest that has already been attained from Christ, attained by Christ focused in justification by faith and not by works. As I try to put it, I think here's another problem with Calvin's view, that it really reduces, it loses a specific force to the fourth commandment as in distinction from the others, and really becomes kind of a general assertion that you could even reduce. For Calvin, the fourth commandment means stop sinning. rest in Christ. Now, of course, that rest is absolutely, that spiritual rest is absolutely essential, but there is more to the rest that was in view in the original weekly Sabbath in view at creation. There's more. There is also that which will not arrive until Christ returns. So that, in terms of that that already not yet attainment of rest, which is rooted in creation, the church exists, having both received rest in Christ and yet looking for the final consummation of that rest in his return. So, well, again, I've gone on at length.
This is superb. So we have, even in the book of Hebrews, the epistle to the Hebrews, and passages in 12, for example, that speak about us as the church having already come to the heavenly Mount Zion, that we're present there, but yet you've treated the exegesis in Hebrews chapter 3 and 4 in our conversation today, but also the book that you mentioned earlier, which is Pressing Toward the Mark, so the listeners can know, Essays Commemorating 50 Years of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Just on page 33, Dr. Gaffin has a chapter titled A Sabbath Rest Still Awaits the People of God, and that's a phrase right out of the book of Hebrews. That section, Hebrews 3 and 4, the whole book, but really that section emphasizes especially this idea of the church as a pilgrim people. What sense then does the pilgrim motif and the idea of the church passing through the wilderness of this world and this age and still on their way toward their final destination? Are you saying that Calvin didn't incorporate that or understand that so much in his understanding of the fourth commandment? He's more already and shortchanges the not yet of Hebrews. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it would certainly be unfair to Calvin and even quite wrong to draw the conclusion, and I'm not suggesting this was in view in your question at all, draw the conclusion that he didn't have a sense of the pilgrim identity of the church.
Certainly.
So much of what he writes and says is so compatible with that. I think, though, on this issue, he fails to see how the writer of Hebrews, let's put it that way, relates that the writer, how in Hebrews the concept of rest is related to the pilgrim identity of the church. Let me give the example, I think, that makes this very clear. I mean, it may be helpful for listeners to look at Hebrews 4, 10, Hebrews 4, verse 10, where the writer is drawing, he begins discussing the Sabbath back at the beginning of chapter 4, where he cites Genesis 2 and 3, and he brings pre-fall considerations into the picture before, as he goes on to talk about the pilgrim identity of the church, or talk about the rest in store for the church in light of its pilgrim identity. And then in 4:10, the writer makes this statement: "For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works as God did from his." Now, if you read Calvin in his commentary on this, he reads that as saying that we are to, in effect, stop trying to justify yourself by works. Receive that spiritual rest. This is a paraphrase of what Calvin, receive that spiritual rest that you have by giving up on trusting in your own works. And I think that that really misses a key point here in what the writer is, you see, drawing a positive comparison which is made emphatic by the way he doesn't say whoever has entered God's rest and has also rested from his works, that is, his self-justifying works, but rested from his works as God did from his.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a positive connection being drawn here between the works of the believer and the works of God in the creation week. Mm. And so that the rest in view here is not to be seen as the rest, say, that's in view in Matthew 11, 28. Come unto me all, Jesus says, those who labor and are heavy laden, I'll give you rest. That's the rest, the spiritual rest that believers already possess. But what the writer has in view here is a rest, even though he expresses it in the past tense, as you can see in the context. As he says in the verse immediately preceding, there a rest remains for the people of God. So he has in view the consummation, the entering into the consummation of rest that will mean the end of the pilgrim identity, of the present pilgrim identity of the church. So, I think all that ties back eventually as the writer's use of Genesis 2 at the beginning of the passage points us to consider what was in view in the original creation ordinance of the Sabbath back in Genesis 2. In other words, we're saying Calvin has missed the fullness of the eschatological, so far as the Sabbath is concerned, has missed the fullness of the rest, the eschatological rest to which the weekly Sabbath sign points.
Would you argue, and is this part of your argument, that for the continuation of the Sabbath day, that only that not until the end of this pilgrim identity of the church, when the church enters into that consummative eschatological state of rest, until that moment, the Sabbath as an earthly sign and foretaste of that eschatological rest continues?
Yeah, you mean, of course, the weekly Sabbath, right?
Yeah, yes, the weekly Sabbath, yeah.
Yes, I think that is the case. In other words, to affirm what the Westminster standards or the Westminster Confession, the Lord's Day is a Christian Sabbath. That weekly Lord's Day observance involves the sabbatical typology. As the writer of Hebrews would say, a rest remains still future for the people of God. So as long as that rest to which the type points is not yet fully realized, the type continues in force.
Hmm.
I think that's the heart of a Sabbath, a weekly Sabbath, a theological explanation for a weekly Sabbath that Calvin is missing.
Hmm. So on Sunday, then, for example, our cessation from our ordinary work is a sign of our final cessation from work. We will cease from our work as God did from his. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that would be a fair way of putting it. Absolutely.
In other words,
very clearly when you read Calvin in the Institutes and elsewhere, there is a weekly rest day is I think the best word to use is a pragmatic consideration.
Hmm.
And I don't use the word pragmatic there pejoratively at all. But it's what Calvin would say, as I tried to sum it up, I think not unfairly, Calvin is saying the fourth commandment, in its nub put negatively, is stop sinning, or worship, give up on your own self-justifying efforts and worship God. Now, he would say ideally we ought to worship God every day of our lives. And but God, because of God out of concessively provides for us to have provides for us so that we have one day in which to worship him. And that day, which I think he indicates can be any day of the week. That's the abiding significance of the fourth commandment, that it mandates weekly, out of a concession to human weakness, it mandates a weekly time of, particularly for corporate or public worship, which, of course, is eminently appropriate and important on the Lord's Day for a Christian Sabbath. But the whole, I think that I'm thinking the way you phrase your question, the whole significance of the Sabbath, ceasing from labor, is not just to provide us time for public worship, however appropriate that is on the Lord's Day, but that becomes meaningful in its own right. The cessation is a sign that we are not dependent on our own efforts, or caught up in an endless cycle of working day after day, but our lives are are structured in terms of a weekly principle, a weekly pattern in which the Sabbath functions to point us that our lives are going somewhere toward a Sabbath rest. So that the particularly in our culture, a cessation of our activities of the other 6 days is particularly of our primary calling, which is good in itself, or can or should be good in itself. Just ceasing from that is an eloquent testimony to the world that we we are not dependent on our own efforts, we're not, as I said, our lives are not caught up in an endless repetition of days that is not really going anywhere. But the week, with its culminating Sabbath, we haven't gotten into this issue, as it begins the week, because as a sign of the realized eschatology that has arrived in the death and resurrection, particularly of Christ, his resurrection, we begin the week with the rest that our lives are going, with the rest type, the sign of rest, that our lives are headed toward an ultimate eschatological rest.
Very good. Thank you very much. It's really helpful. The cessation of work in the weekly Sabbath in itself is a sign of the eschaton. I think that's what I hear you saying. But I, as someone who's very interested in the subject of Christian worship, I would also add, I think you would do this too, that the worship activity of the church on the Lord's Day, the church assembling for the purpose of worship, is also a foretaste of the eschaton and a participation in the worship of the eschaton. The fourth commandment not only requires the cessation of work, it also requires a holy convocation, an assembly for worship, and that too is a foretaste of the eschaton. Is that something you would also say?
Oh, yes, by all means, I would see that as integral, an integral aspect of what the Lord's Day is about. And I think that can be affirmed without being undermined in any way by recognizing that the rest, however it is to be filled, the rest has positive significance. Now, immediately, it's to be central to that rest is what you know, as you expressed it very well, the place of worship, particularly corporate worship. The two things. You know, I've been very much influenced in some of the ideas I express in the book, and been trying to express here with a perspective that Voss provides. I wonder, could I take the time, I have it quoted in the book, to read a quote from Voss that I think is worth highlighting. This is on page 156. And is a quote where he is in his from his biblical theology, where he's dealing with the issue of the Sabbath and its significance. It's page 157. Well, I'm working with an older edition of the biblical theology. I'm not sure exactly what page it would be in the Banner of Truth edition that has a different pagination, unfortunately, I would say. But readers can track it down. But Calvin, Voss says this: from what has been said about the typical sacramental meaning of the Sabbath, it follows that it would be a mistake to base its observance primarily on the ground of utility. Let me just interrupt my reading of Voss and just comment briefly. See, he's making a point, I think, that is countering the way Calvin sees the Sabbath as is basically on the ground of utility, according to Calvin, that we have the fourth commandment. Then Voss continues, the Sabbath is not the outcome of an abnormal state of affairs in which it is impossible, apart from the appointment of a fixed day, to devote sufficient care to the religious interests of life. On such a view, it might be maintained that for one sufficiently at leisure to give all his time to the cultivation of religion, the keeping of the Sabbath would no longer be obligatory. Some of the continental reformers, out of reaction to the Romish system of holy days, reasoned after this fashion. But they reasoned wrongly. The Sabbath is not in the first place a means of advancing religion. It has its main significance apart from that in pointing forward to the eternal issues of life and history. Even the most advanced religious spirit cannot absolve itself from partaking in that. It is a serious question, Voss continues, whether the modern church has not too much lost sight of this by making the day well nigh exclusively an instrument of religious propaganda. I mean, just a commentary. He doesn't mean propaganda in a negative or pejorative sense there, but in the sense of advancing religious knowledge. At the expense, he says, it's a question whether the modern church has not too much lost sight of this by making the day well nigh exclusively an instrument of religious propaganda at the expense of its eternity typifying value. Of course, it goes without saying that a day devoted to the remembrance of man's eternal destiny cannot be properly observed without the positive cultivation of those religious concerns, which are so intimately joined to the final issue of his lot. But even where this is conceded, the fact remains that it is possible to crowd too much into the day that is merely subservient to religious propaganda and to void it too much of the static Godward and heavenly word-directed occupation of piety. And as I observe in the footnote to that quote of Voss, though Calvin is not named, a critique of his views, among others, as one of the continental reformers that Voss mentions, that seems to me to be clear. So, I prompted to read that quote because I think it captures so much of what I'm concerned. And I think thinking of Glenn's question, you see how he sees worship as a central, but not, as he puts it, it must not, and religious propaganda, in the sense of inculcating what the Bible teaches, the propaganda that's all very good in and of itself, but we shouldn't crowd so much into the day that we lose sight, as Voss puts it, of its eternity-typifying value. And I guess that eternity-typifying value captures so much of what I think it's important to appreciate about an ongoing weekly Sabbath until that eternity arrives in its fullness. And as an outcome of so much of study, including my study of Calvin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's powerful. We really appreciate that. And this is always something that we do well to meditate upon further and to think more deeply about the eschatological significance here, but also the already not yet aspect of the Sabbath and the Lord's Day for us. And as the Lord reminds us, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath, but yet we don't always take the Lord's blessing as he has given it to us. And we think we know better what we need rather than how the Lord has created and how he's directed us to worship him, to serve him, and to rest in him, but also to continue moving on as pilgrims in this land toward our heavenly and our final rest. So, Dr. Gaffanuna, thank you so much for writing this book and sharing it with us today, but also for taking the time out of your day to speak with us on the phone. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you, and I hope this our time together will be helpful to listeners in reflecting on the central reality of what our salvation in Christ is all about and what the weekly Sabbath serves to point us to in that regard.
We do too. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can find out more information about what Reformed Forum is up to, as well as several resources on the Sabbath and Reformed worship. I'd like to point you to our special section that Glenn edits and writes, contributes to at reformedforum.org/worship. We have our ancient Reformed worship section there. A lot of great material. And of course, information about our upcoming conference, October 7th through 9th, 2016, is available at reformedforum.org/conference. I want to thank everybody for listening and hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.